The Blue Cliff Record, Case 84, Vimalakirti's Gate of Non-Duality. The Pointer. Though you say, it is, there is nothing which is can affirm. Though you say, it is not, there is nothing that is not can negate. When is and is not are left behind, and gain and loss are forgotten, then you are clean and naked, free and at ease. But tell me, what is in front of you and in back of you? If there is a patrobe monk who comes forward and says, in the front is the Buddha shrine and the main gate, behind is the abbot's sleeping room and private quarters. Tell me, does this person have eyes or not? If you can judge this one, I'll allow that you have personally seen the ancients. The case. Vimalakirti asked Manjushri, what is the Bodhisattva gate to the Dharma of not to? Manjushri said, my idea is this. In all phenomena, there are no words, no explanations, no presentations, no consciousness. There is freedom from all questions and answers. That is the Dharma gate of not to. Jwedo asks, what will Vimalakirti say? And Jwedo responds, I know all about that. So, Vimalakirti is sick. The world, on behalf of the world, in solidarity with the world, Vimalakirti is sick. And he's such a fierce Dharma combatant that everyone is too scared to go and be with this poor sick being. The Buddha is very clear. The Buddha says that caring for sick community members is a responsibility of the Sangha. And the Buddha says too that caring for ourselves, caring for others, we care for ourselves. And caring for ourselves, we care for others. But no one will go see poor poor Vimalakirti. And Manjushri draws the short straw. Buddha says, well, no one will do it, so it falls to you. And Manjushri shows up. There's another... going to see sick Zen teachers is apparently quite a provocative situation. There's another koan where I believe it's Dongshan who's unwell, and a monk says, are you sick? And Dongshan says, yes, yes, I am. And the monk says, is there one who's not sick, though? And Dongshan says, yes, there is one who is not sick. But there's one who's sick. And here Vimalakirti is bringing that forth. And it can seem like Manjushri is jabbering away quite a bit here. And Manjushri in Zen sometimes seems like he's a bit of a clown, a bit of a buffoon. And while the buffoon presentation is near and dear to my heart and is a great practice of mine, there's also more going on here. There's another koan in which Manjushri appears to be distressed, put off, concerned, that he's unable to bring this young woman out of samadhi. And instead, the bodhisattva of delusive wisdom does what Manjushri, the bodhisattva of transcendent, non-dual wisdom, cannot do. Why is that? There's another koan in a collection called the Iron Flute, where Manjushri stands at the threshold to the Zendo and says, I cannot enter. Poor Manjushri. Or perhaps Manjushri is vividly teaching us too. This Dharma gate of not to, this Dharma gate of not to, the Bodhisattva gate of not to, this is our practice. The Shinshin Ming, the song of the entrusting heart, has a line in it which says, immediately affirm not to. This is what our Shikantaza is, an affirmation of that not to. In our sutra book, in the part of the longer reading we didn't do, Shohaku Okamura says, Zazen goes beyond and yet includes complete acceptance and complete negation of all that arises. And this is what the pointer is pointing to. Well, it's gone now. This is what the pointer is pointing to, where he says, don't imagine there is an it is to affirm. Don't imagine there is an it is not to negate. So our Shikantaza is entrusting ourselves to this immediately affirming not to. Whatever shows up, immediately affirm not to. Entrust to not to. And don't imagine that immediately affirming is immediately affirming not to is a thing you can do. But don't imagine that it is not a thing worth doing in each moment. Julie picked up on what are also my on the first day what are also my favorite part of this koan, where Manjushri says, well, in my opinion, in my view, for me, what I see is, I was at a conference a number of years ago, and one of the people on the panel was a fellow named Gil Fronsdahl. Gil Fronsdahl has Dharma transmission in the Soto Zen lineage of Shunryu Suzuki. He is on the Guiding Teachers Council of the Insight Meditation Society. He has a doctoral degree in Buddhist studies from Stanford and is the dean of the Institute of Buddhist Studies at Berkeley. And someone asked him, so what does Buddhism have to say about... And he said, well, I can't really answer that question. I can say, well, in Gil's opinion... And then he gave us Gil's opinion. And if anyone was qualified to speak for what Buddhism has to say, it seemed to me it would be Gil Fronsdahl in that moment. And yet he deferred. And all he spoke of was what he sees, which is exactly what Manjushri is doing. This, the power of, well, for me, what I can see, interestingly, whatever we follow that with will be true. When I'm working with new practice leaders who are just beginning to give beginning orientations to people, or when I'm working with new Dharma teachers who are just beginning to give talks and respond to questions in Dharma dialogue, and when I'm working with new senior Dharma teachers who are just beginning to meet students in Dzogchen, I say that if you ever feel completely flummoxed by a question, just say, "Well, for me," and then see what you can follow that up with. Even if when you say, "Well, for me," you don't quite know where you're going to go. But that will be true. That will be your Dharma coming forth. My idea is this: in all phenomena, Manjushri says, there are no words, no explanations, no presentations, no consciousness. There is freedom from all questions and answers. So, is Manjushri giving an explanation? Or is this explanation no explanation? How would you demonstrate no consciousness? Is that a special state of blank mind that you bring? And if so, how do you present it? Is that presentation a presentation or no presentation? There is freedom from all questions and answers. Manjushri is giving us all excellent advice here on how to meet a koan in Dzogchen. No explanation, no presentation, no consciousness, and freedom from all questions and answers. The teacher may ask a question. How can you bring forth freedom from all questions and answers? You may have an understanding arising in your mind. How can you bring that forth as no understanding? Manjushri is actually enacting profound generosity here. He is fully demonstrating, entering into the Dharma gate of not two. The not two that includes even two. This is the Dharma gate of not two, he says. Jwedo wonders, what will Vimalakirti say? And Vimalakirti also responds, also brings out in profound generosity the entire universe of not two. He's not just copping out here. He is offering absolutely everything in full knowledge that nothing needs to be offered, that the gate of not to can't even be entered. So broad is it. This is like when there's a koan in the gateless gate. When an outsider comes and asks the Buddha a question, he says, "I do not ask for speech. I do not ask for silence. So tell me, what is it?" And the Buddha just sits still. And the outsider hears that thundering silence and bows in deep appreciation. So, Jwedo knows all about that. How about you? What do you know? So, for me, in my view, this is how I feel like I understand this koan.
Thank you, Josh. I hope you can hear me. I'm recovering from a little laryngitis, so I can't project my voice too much. But just so beautiful to listen to Josh's view, and so beautiful when we get to listen to anyone's view of koan, koan in a collection, koan in our lives, this intimacy that we're invited in, and to know that these koans are living and breathing. They're not ancient stories. They are our own personal encounters, and we all have to find our way in. And so, in my view, this lovely story, Josh talking about Manjushri kind of babbling before the sick Vimalakirti, reminded me of what is very common when someone is very ill, when someone is dying, that people come and feel great unease, don't know how to respond, and there's often a lot of talking in the room where the dying person is, and the dying person at that point often can't respond verbally. There's no option to respond verbally. We're still there and conscious, and often we believe hearing and sensate, but verbal communication is lost to them. And so this babbling that goes on, given in love, even if misguided love, and to me received in love, the way of speaking and being silent, two ways in which we human beings come forward in life. This, for me, this koan is so easy for us to get hooked on parts of it. And Josh so incisively explained how to avoid those hooks, I think. But for me, the hook in the beginning is this Manjushri babbling about no words, no... He says, freedom from questions and answers. Doesn't that sound just lovely? Wouldn't you just love to be completely free from questions and answers? And so whenever I encounter that kind of reaction to something, it's a little sign for me that there's a big juicy worm sitting out there that I'm waiting to bite into the iron hook there. And then the second hook that I see in this is actually Vimalakirti's response. And I love that Josh chose to use the translation in our koan collection, because we've heard wonderfully about the Vimalakirti Sutra, and we know that Vimalakirti's response was his thundering silence. But in this koan translation, it actually doesn't say that Vimalakirti was silent. Instead, what happens is Shweta says, what did Vimalakirti say? So, and I thought there's a comment here from Hakuin on this case, and it says, he, meaning Shweta, is averse to referring to Vimalakirti's silence as silence. Yet, if he does not say it, people will accept silence. So he spoke as if he were hard of hearing. What did Vimalakirti say? So, Shweta is trying to help us avoid that hook of that's it. Can't you just picture Vimalakirti there? I see him as kind of a glow off of his, you know, robes, and just complete silence and bliss and deep samadhi as he prepares for death, you know. So we can so easily develop these conceptual frameworks of, this is what I need to do. I need to be quiet. I need to be silent. I need to enter into, this is the Dharma gate of non-duality. We're all looking for that answer, you know, that one solid answer that we can hang on to. And so this silence, thundering silence, right? What's wrong with that? All day long, there are non-verbal bodhisattvas calling out to us. The teacup that we pick up in the morning, right? And the steps in the zendo, right? And the sounds and the wind and all of these non-verbal bodhisattvas calling to us in this beautiful silent container that we've created, which is so powerful. The deep and wonderful silence of Zazen, our true teacher, so much to be learned from silence. And yet when we make it into a thing, which human beings are so capable of doing, then we get hooked. The Zazen is not about disengaging from the world. Quite the contrary. It is about living our life every day, including every day here in the Zendo, every moment, living it fully. And when we can feel our way into the ever-changing nature of our thoughts, our emotions, our sensations, the world around us, everything in transit, and we a part of it, then there's some settling in. We let go of our concepts, our ideas, our things that we're trying to grasp onto, and then there is simply the aliveness of this moment. The Buddha Dharma presents itself every single moment, and yet we recite it constantly, and we think it, but we don't believe it. We don't act like we believe it. And here in Sesshin, we have this wonderful, precious opportunity to actually practice that the Buddha Dharma is here in everything, and we are alive and can be awake to it. And it is only through this little human body that we have that we can connect to it. How wonderful! How wonderful!
So, please sit comfortably and be invited to come forth in our practice of Dharma dialogue. Comments, resonances, questions. And we will be joined as a respondent by Dharma holder Mike Felix.
Reverend.
Alan.
One thing that hasn't come up in the talks yet is that in the translation I read of the Vimalakirti Sutra some time ago, it's quite clear that Vimalakirti is feigning being ill. It's not actually sick, but he's feigning being sick so that he can generate everything that happens afterwards. And I wonder if anyone has a comment on that.
So, and the Heart Sutra says no old age and death, and no ending to old age and death. So the only illness we ever bring forth is feigning, and is real illness. Vimalakirti isn't faking that he's sick because the world is sick. He is sick, as are we, because the world is sick. And even and so let us, we were in the opening comments on the first night of Sesshin, we were called to recall the privilege that we have to be able to set aside time to have a body that can come here, a mind that can do this, a circumstance in life to let us practice. And we practice because the world is sick and we are sick. Don't be limited by how awesome it is to be you and how terrible.
Just a small association. When you were talking about Jue Do being hard of hearing, I immediately in my head heard Bamla Puru saying, "Blessed are the cheesemakers."
Thank you both so much. So just a couple of really strong resonances for me. One is this sickness, this room where Vimalakirti is. What's been coming up for me is being like sensing that sick room, that small little 10 by 10 sick room. And it makes me think of when I visit my mom, who is now in a nursing home, and lives in a sick room. And when he's silent, what came up for me was all of the sensations that hit me when I walk into her sick room. My mother's not able to speak much anymore. She's able to speak, but in other words, her mouth works, but the mind does no longer. And so the smells and all of the things that come with human beings being sick and in various stages of decline and moving toward dying. Mm-hmm. And some of them are not pleasant at all, these sick rooms. They are not places that I think most of us, including me, would normally choose to want to hang out for long periods of time. And yet, I want to hang out in her sick room with her. Mm-hmm. Many of you know that I go to visit her often and as often as I can, and the more often I go, the more it's easy for me to be with not just her in her sick room, but all the people there who are in their sick rooms. Not that I go visit them all, but it's just one big sick room.
Yeah. And as you're talking, I can't help thinking that how each one of us, our body is one sick room, right? Yeah. You know, from the moment of birth as we go on, right? Yeah. This is the nature of human existence. And more than that, you know, as Josh was talking, you know, there's so much sickness and injury and throughout the world. And it is part of us, you know, it's part of, but we're not separate from it. We might not like bring it to consciousness all the time, but we include it all, and so it's all this life that we've been given or taken. It is this commitment, right, that we will be in the sick room, just like you commit to being with your mom and then with others. And the more we commit to being in it, the more we can be open to everyone else in their sick rooms.
Yeah. Me in the sick room.
Yeah.
And I think for me, the more surprised I am about what I find in the sick room, the sick room of my own mental struggles and challenges and heart, the sick room of my mother dying. And in those moments of encountering, for example, a woman who could no longer speak, to be surprised by the aliveness that was there, the chortling, bubbly laughter on occasion, a flash of anger, or I never knew what was coming next. There's this thing about in this koan, and I think Alan also brought it up with this, this feigning. For me, it's a way of describing that would be of not being sure about what I find in the sick room, about even the things that I label in advance as bad, to turn toward them and not really know. And there's possibility.
Is the world really sick, or is that just a judgment?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So sick and not sick. And what world?
You mentioned remember you call back to that reminder that we've had to consider the privilege we have to be here, and it occurs to me that a lot of that privilege is built on the sickness of the world and the sickness of the sick, from the people who supported us growing up, like my parents who were gone in their sick rooms, to the sickness in society that is built into the system that, where I make a lot of money and now I can afford to do it time. So I'm just thinking of that connection.
Yeah.
It's actually required. Mm-hmm. Or I've been part of what causes it.
And so interesting. And there's some, I heard someone talk about how that we are born and subject to death is what is a great gift, because it causes us to undertake this grand inquiry, when we become cognizant and conscious of it. So this sickness, is it sickness, right? Death, is it death, right? Is it just all practice? Oh, practice, just practice. So, is this, so Mike was talking about how all of these factors, sickness, contributes to his being here, our being here, and is it the case that all our dying, is our opportunity, right, to engage in this practice? Maybe, it's, death is not what we think it is, So it's, but thank you for your question. I'm appreciating it.
And I want to name that there is a lot unwell with the world right now. In there is much suffering and much harm causing. And this is not us who do it.
I really want to pick up on this. It seems like it's again that issue of it being so easy to fall into one side or the other. That, oh good, there's no sickness, there's no worry, let's go home. And so wanting to also honor that, in being curious, in paying attention, sometimes what we find is a surprise. Sometimes what we find is tears, is pain, is anguish, and that's, they're both just as real and unreal. It's that, for me, it's that what we get to practice here is continually turning toward it and being surprised again and again without knowing what it's going to end up showing up as. It may show up as feigned, and it may show up as real.
This talk of sickness and feigning it, it makes me think of, you know, when I was a kid, sometimes I'd pretend to be sick so I could stay home from school. And, you know, I would feel not great because I was lying. But looking back at it, I think my mother knew that I was faking it. And, you know, and now today, you know, we have like sick days at work. There's a gradation around sickness, I think. It's not necessarily a bad thing. And, you know, I've also experienced loss of people and losing them without any sickness. They were just gone. And in some ways, there's this natural progression that I missed because of that. And I wouldn't wish it on anybody, but at the same time, there is a part of death and the change that the sickness allows certain things to happen. That's what came up for me.
I also wanted to comment on the response of silence and how powerful that was in the koan. I have a hard time sometimes socially because I'm a really good listener and I'm not a really good talker. And so, like, I go walking with my neighbors a lot and they're just talk, 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 and I'm just listening and maybe saying a few things, but I'm really listening. And then, at one point, my neighbor, who I walked with, went on a trip, and beforehand, she stopped and gave me a big hug and said, "I'll really miss you." Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, you know, I always feel like she doesn't even know me. I didn't have a chance to show up, you know, I mean, really express myself at all. And yet, she felt very validated by me, like, really, really important. Mm-hmm. And I just realized, wow, maybe the silence really is speaking in a way I wasn't even aware of.
Beautiful, beautifully said, and so lovely here on Sashin, right? We can see how the silence speaks, right? Not to our ears, but to our heart. And when we practice together in silence, alone together, it's really so extraordinary how much affection we develop for people we may not even know, people we're not talking to, we're not interacting with it in hardly any way at all, and yet there is this great sense of connection, right, created by the silence. Such a lovely tradition that, you know, someone was saying, hundreds of years, this practice of Zazen has passed down.
Edward?
It's really interesting to me that how a koan can become alive at just one odd sort of moment, how it twists. This is getting close to the 24th anniversary of my father's death. And it was in a 10x10 room, you know, in a hospital. And he was lying there feigning being in a coma. Feigning taking his last breath and feigning being dead. And it was such a gift. I was up here in Winchester, and my father and my mother lived down in New Jersey. I was going to go down to spell my mother because she was taking care of him as he was dying. And she called me up and said, oh, don't bother. He's, you know, the squad came and took him away to the hospital. I always loved the way she used the squad. he apparently had, he was losing, he wasn't getting enough oxygen, so he became kind of manic and pulled the doors off a closet. And it's a really small guy. But she had them take him off to the hospital. And she went, oh, don't bother, you don't have to spell me. So, you know, I knew that I had no choice. You know, I drove down. I can remember getting on, I think it was like 295 in New Jersey, and I was listening to Samuel Barber's Knoxville 1915. There's a line in it. But it doesn't matter. You know, all I could do was pull over to the side of the road and cry. And I got there, and we spent the weekend at his bedside listening to this sort of conversation. You know, my mother being nervous and not knowing what to say, and she tends to talk much more than I do, or tended to talk. She's been dead 4 years now. So she was talking on, and the nurse was being very straightforward. You know, my mother was going, well, is it normal for one foot to be cold and the other foot to be warm? And the nurse going, oh, yes, that's perfectly normal. You know, he's shutting down. And just having the opportunity to stand there by his bedside and seeing his last breath as he feigned dying. And I never thought of him as a bodhisattva. I always thought this was a tremendous gift he gave me, but I never thought of him as a bodhisattva. So thank you all.
and so, with that, let us enter the bodhisattva gate of not too immediately affirming, not too amid this thundering, vivid, luminous silence.